hier noch den Bogen in die Schweiz zu schlagen im Kontext von Kriminalisierung von Armut. Wir möchten hier daran erinnern, dass hier in der Schweiz mehr als ein Drittel der Menschen im Gefängnis wegen sogenanntem Schwarzfahren oder Nichtbezahlen von Rechnungen sitzen.
Und jetzt müssen wir gleich weitermachen. Wir wollten eigentlich ein Lied hören, Fuck le 17. Was heißt Fuck le 17?
Niklapolis heißt das.
Okay, super. ja, das hätten wir gehört, können wir euch empfehlen. Aber wir haben jetzt ein Interview bereit für euch. Das haben wir heute, also Sidonia hat das heute mit Chris Whitman von Medico International in Palästina und Israel gemacht. Also er arbeitet dort für sie. Er ist based in Kubarak, südlich von Ramallah. Wir haben im Kontext der Militärinvasion im Westjordanland über die aktuelle Situation vor Ort gesprochen und vor allem auch über die Auswirkungen auf seine Arbeit im Kontext von Medico International. Entstanden ist ein einstündiges Gespräch, von welchem wir euch aus Zeitgründen heute nur Teile laufen lassen können. Das ganze Interview werden wir dann aber zum Nachhören ein anderes Mal laufen lassen oder auf Spotify hochladen. Das Interview ist auf Englisch, wir hatten keine Zeit, es auf Deutsch zu übersetzen, aber wir glauben an euch, dass ihr das durchsteht. Plus, wir können auch nicht immer drüber sprechen. Dann hört ihr mal andere Stimmen.
Das stimmt, ja.
Das wäre auch schade gewesen.
Und wenn sich jemand das Transkript wünscht, kann man immer auf uns zukommen.
Ja, sorry, aber jetzt viel Spaß bei diesem super tollen, super spannenden Interview.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, I am the representative of Medico International here in Palestine and in Israel. I've been in this position for almost 4 years now, and this is not my first time living here. I lived here for 7 years prior. I have my master's degree from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and after that, I worked at a number of Israeli and Palestinian NGOs, working in issues such as labor rights, women-led advocacy, settlements in the occupied West Bank, among other issues. So this is obviously both an academic and professional and personal issue for me, an involvement in it. And in terms of what Medico International does, we have been working here for almost 50 years. We originally started in the mid-80s, although we did have some projects before that, mostly to support local organizations, both Israeli and Palestinian, around the issue of health. And over the years, this grew and developed. And we established an office in the late 90s, early 2000s. And we have had numerous projects since then, some that have been with German government support, such as our ongoing and current project in the Gaza Strip to combat the issue of chronic diseases, such as diabetes, hypertension. Mm-hmm. And also we've had German government funding for projects in the West Bank to promote and protect Palestinian farmers who live in what's called Area C, who are at risk of settler violence and land confiscation by the army and by settlers. But unfortunately, by the end of 2022, that project was canceled. Mm-hmm. But we still are working with partners on all sorts of different issues, from archival research to an art collective in Gaza to prison and detainee issues to health. We have our fingers in a little bit of everything, which allows us to have a more unique perspective than one-issue organizations or organizations with a much more limited mandate. We have a much broader mandate, which allows us to touch more aspects and more issues.
I would love to circle back to the different issues you're dealing with or the different social struggles that you're facing in your work at Medico. But first, it would be nice if you, from your perspective, could give us an overview of what happened over the last few weeks in the West Bank, in Palestine, specifically in Tulkarem, Jenin, and Tubas.
The whole-scale destruction that is happening in these border areas and other cities such as Qalqilia or Tubas has been going on for many years. Although it has dramatically intensified since October 7th, all the things that the Israelis are doing today, they were doing 3 years ago. And I don't say that in the sense of giving a pass to it. What I say is that these are longstanding goals that they're trying to achieve in these areas through the use of brute force and brute violence. And the attacks on the 7th of October and the ongoing war on Gaza has taken a lot of the media attention away from what's going on there. So what is going on in Tulkarem, Jenin, Tubas, Qalqilia is that you have what the Israelis are trying to do is what we call in the NGO world the Gazaification of the West Bank, where they are targeting and trying to isolate geographically, politically, economically these Palestinian cities. And they're using settlements, they're using army incursions to basically squeeze Palestinians in these areas into smaller and smaller localities, more Palestinians on less land. And as this process is happening, unsurprisingly, there is Palestinian armed resistance to this. And this additionally then gives like a retroactive approval from the Israeli mindset to then be even more brutal in these areas. So what you see is a slow grinding down of these cities to make them into isolated islands in a sea of Israeli settlements, of Israeli military bases, of walls, closed zones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what we've seen in the past 4 weeks especially is this being done as a major large-scale intentional campaign in multiple localities at once. Typically, these attacks will happen at one, maybe two of these cities, and they usually last between 6 and 24 hours. This time, we had a three-city campaign that went on for essentially 10 days, which also involved forceful evacuation of hundreds of families, not dissimilar to what has been going on in Gaza. You have the sieging and the closing off of hospitals, the destruction of parts of hospitals, and large destruction of whole blocks of Palestinian residential areas, mostly in or around the camps, the refugee camps that are in these cities. So, I mean, in terms of what can be done in terms of stopping this? Something that's very common within Palestinian discourse is to emphasize or to highlight what's called samud, which means one's steadfastness to stay and to remain on their land. The problem is, obviously, that people can only stay for so long before they are just forcibly displaced, which we've had about 32 communities in the West Bank that have been forcibly displaced since October 7th, 2023. Now, there's an alternative trend as well, which I mentioned before, which is a resort to armed resistance. But when you're dealing with a nuclear power that has 400,000 infantry units of soldiers, when you have, you know, they have F-16s and F-35s and every single military capability and materials from the West, it is not as if Israel has an unwillingness or a moral problem with killing Palestinians who do not do what they want them to do. So in the face of that, we are, I would say, eyeball deep in the process of a settler colonial project where the ability for them to actually resist, they don't have the material capacity, They are in many ways facing the entire world, or at least the entire Western world, in this endeavor. Mm-hmm. And any attempts to actually to confront militarily are then demonized, delegitimized. They're called terrorists. So for many years, Palestinians have tried to find other ways, Gandhian methods, to find, say, the copying is the tactics in terms of creating facts in the ground, but they don't have the resources to do this, one. And then two, they're still killed anyways. Mm-hmm. One of the largest peaceful protests that have happened in the region was when you had tens of thousands of Palestinians who were marching towards the borders in Gaza. And what happened? You had Israeli snipers maim, kill, and disfigure tens of thousands of Palestinians. And so it doesn't matter which course Palestinians take, they will be facing an uphill battle regardless.
And in the context of working for or with medical, you mentioned working rights, you mentioned healthcare, you mentioned the prison system. How do these military invasions on the ground affect your work or the work of people who work in contexts of like those grassrooted projects or networks?
Okay, so let's look at the three issues that you picked, which are absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. If we're looking at workers' rights, if we're looking at access to health, and if we're looking at prison and detention. Now, every single one of those issues has dramatically become, has become much more dramatic since October 7th, and especially since the large-scale invasion of the West Bank about 3.5 weeks ago. So in terms of detention, Israel is currently holding officially about 10,000 Palestinians. Of those, about 35% are what is called administrative detention, which means detention without charge, detention without access to a lawyer. It usually means solitary confinement. And all of this is done in an Israeli military court system, in a language that most Palestinians don't speak, and can be renewed every 3 or 6 months with little to no reason. They don't, the state doesn't need to provide anything. Nobody's forcing Israel to actually have proper mechanisms here. But in general, the prison population has more than doubled. Now, this is officially. We also know unofficially Israel is holding 1, 2, 3, 4,000 more Palestinians from Gaza as enemy combatants or illegal combatants, something mm-hmm. for your listeners who are be my age and older, remember from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they also have off-site prisons such as Guantanamo. Here they call it Sede Temon, mm-hmm. Or they call it Zikim. So in terms of this, you have a mass campaign of Palestinians who have been arrested since October 7th, up to and including in the most recent incursions, and up to and including yesterday. Just to give people some context about these incursions, since the 7th of October, in the West Bank, we've had 697 Palestinians who have been killed in just the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And of those, we just had 8 in the past 12 hours, essentially. We had one just down the street from my house in a place called Columbia, where somebody was shot by the Israelis early this morning, and he was announced dead 20 minutes before our call. And then we had 7 Palestinians who were killed in a village just south of Jenin called Kibbetzia. And they were killed yesterday evening during a large military invasion, which sieged the schools in that village, of which there were about 800 children who were at gunpoint forced to stay in their schools. Mm-hmm. And then the Israelis assassinated 7 people, 2 of them by a drone, five of them by shot. And I don't know if you've seen the video. The Israelis killed three men on a rooftop and then kicked their bodies off of the roof, which were then kicked into a bulldozer. And the Israelis brought them back to Israel, where they will hold them as ransom in negotiations today or in 10 years. The Israelis are holding hundreds of Palestinian bodies. So this is the tension, in a way, because those are trying to arrest and many times get killed. Now, if you look at, say, issues of health, like I mentioned in this large-scale incursion that we had a few weeks ago, the Israelis besieged about six hospitals between Jenin and Tokadam and one in Tubas, where they basically strip-searched ambulance drivers who were bringing injured women, children, men to the hospital. Whether they were injured in the fighting or whether they just had a medical test to do didn't matter. They were being strip-searched, detained, questioned. And in Tokadam specifically, the Israelis damaged heavily one area of Thabat Hospital. So in terms of, you know, and it's not as if healthcare is, you know, top-notch, similar to Zurich or London or New York or anything, extremely underfunded, under-accessed places, but that's all they have. So when these areas are then being destroyed, being targeted, whatever else, people's access and ability and willingness to even go to these places, which are supposed to be universal symbols of not having hostilities in them, have become battlegrounds for the Israelis to actively use in their offensives. And now in terms of workers' rights, since the 7th of October, the Israelis have canceled all permits for Palestinians to work inside of Israel or in the Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. Now, it has reversed about somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 of these for very specific Palestinians to work in very specific settlements, but the overwhelming majority have continued to lose their work. Now, they can't access unemployment, pension, any of these things unless they give up their right to that permit. So they are sitting with no income, no safety net, no ability from the Palestinian Authority to take care of them. They're just sitting unemployed. We're talking about 180,000 Palestinians, about 25% of the workforce. So unemployment in the West Bank in general is about 40 to 45%, including these workers. And now those who are employed, are most of them are employed by the Palestinian Authority, which means they haven't had a full paycheck in about a year. Most of them are getting 60 to 70% of their salary. And there's nothing that they can do about this. So you have workers who are unable to access their pensions, their unemployment rights and benefits in the Israeli system, because that will forfeit their permit in the future. And you have those who are working for the Palestinian Authority who haven't been able, have not gotten a full paycheck in a year. And so you have all these different rights violations, all these different tools of squeezing the population even more, making them more desperate, more vulnerable. Borrowing is through the roof. People are extremely, they're suffering economically here, very much so. The Israelis do not just use one tool to squeeze Palestinians, use all the tools at their disposal. The question is how much and when.
You are a representative in Palestine and in Israel. I was wondering, because the Israeli left somehow seems to be rarely existent or with an agenda that doesn't really mention some kind of systemic problem of colonialism in this region. I was wondering how the work within this NGO context is within the Israeli left, maybe map us some organizations that are criticizing this whole system of apartheid.
Sure. No, this is a fantastic question. I rarely get asked questions about Israeli society, despite the fact that it makes up half of my job. So I'm very happy to talk about it. Now, when you say the Israeli left, it usually brings up a certain type of image. Now, I'm going to kind of break it down into two different types. I would say that you have who are the overwhelming majority that are basically centrist or center-left liberals. This is the overwhelming majority of what is called the Israeli left. Now, I usually, when I speak about the Israeli left, I'm speaking about people that would feel radical, not only within their own society, but other societies, people who are, I would say not only anti-occupation because it looks bad, but they're anti-occupation or anti-colonization out of principle, you know, a principled left versus a practical left, or a liberal left versus a Marxist left. And in Israel, a Marxist left is incredibly fringe, incredibly small. This principled ideological left, it does exist, but it's incredibly small. And those who are involved in the NGO world in some way or another tend to be those who are usually engaged in what are called maybe obstruction activism, where they will usually be living with Palestinian communities who are at high risk of settler violence or forceful transfer or attacks by the army. So these are usually Palestinian communities that are in the South Hebron Hills, like you mentioned, Masafer Yatta, also in the northern Jordan Valley, in areas like Al-Farasiyye or Ain al-Baida. These areas, you will find a few dozen Israelis in each place, upwards of 100, who are regularly there to document, to call the police, to basically stand as, in many ways, as human shields. Mm-hmm. And this Israeli left is, I would say personally, inspiring, ideologically driven, principled, people that you would admire regardless of the context and that you would say are doing great work. Now, the liberal left are in many ways mirror my own home country of the United States. They're the people who are personally liberal on issues, say, such as gay rights or feminism, whatever, however you wish to take that. We could talk for hours about what that actually means, but this is how they self-identify. They would probably call themselves progressive on issues of race, even as long as you don't talk about Palestinians. They would be incredibly secular. Most of them would not be. They would find religion to be an anathema to them. So they would be very comfortable in, say, my home city of Boston, where mm-hmm. they would be they're mostly middle to upper class. They'd be very comfortable in this kind of Democrat, blue state type social progressive. But anything involving Palestinians, if you were to do surveys, you'd find that ideologically they're very similar to the far right in Israel, and that they would be considered extremely unprincipled, non-ideological, extremely racist types. And they are the ones who are leading what we see in Israel called the protest movement. They wish to maintain Israel as this beacon of Western civilization in a sea of barbarism. So this is definitely the most dominant trend within Israel in terms of a non-fascist ideology or movement. But obviously for us, that's not very inspiring or interesting or not something we want to invest much time in. Now, the NGO sector in Israel tends to be a mix of different types of center-left liberals with ideological left. So you have organizations, for example, Kerem Navot. That's K-E. This is an organization that is dedicated to documenting all the different colonization methods and processes of the settlers. Mm-hmm. And this is run by somebody who is a dear friend of mine. great organization. If you look at an organization like B'Tselem, or an organization like Adullah, there Hamoked, or there are plenty of Israeli NGOs working on a large swath of issues, but the problem is that they are a very small minority trying to use methods of change that would be nice in an ideal liberal democracy, but Israel is not a liberal democracy, let alone an ideal one. It is a state with a goal, and that goal is maximum land, minimal Palestinians. So there is very little ideology that we would consider foundational to our branches of government existing in Israel. This is incredibly minimal. I can make it really quick. Mm-hmm. Listen, what I'll say is this, is that, it's constantly asked, what does Palestine need to stop having atrocities being done or war crimes being done? The simple answer to this is to stop supporting them, and to hold your own states accountable for what they're doing. We don't need you to come here and to see it yourself. People have been documenting the crimes for 100 years. They need you to first believe them, and then they need you to work on it in your own societies. Because without German money, without American money, without British arms, without all of this, without the legitimacy that Israel is given on a daily basis, they would not be able to get away with any of this. And so no matter how much is done here locally for the repression to really stop, the money needs to stop, the legitimacy needs to stop, and these institutions need to be held accountable for their involvement with it. And it's not a short process. It will not happen in my lifetime, and that's okay. I'm 38, and I know that, and that's okay. But it's not fun work. It's incredibly difficult work that you are going to be constantly defamed, accused of anti-Semitism, blah, blah, blah. That's okay. As long as you stay principled and you're fighting for this cause and you are doing the hard work, it involves a lot of education. It's going to involve a lot of grassroots mobilizing and organizing and finding the targets to actually to go after for accountability and for justice. And it's going to take a lot of times of losses, and that's okay. For me, it's a cause worth fighting for. And if it is for others, they have to see it the same way. There is no, there's not going to be a Mandela moment here. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's possible, but let's also be serious about the success of, of Mandela. That took generations. And that involved a process of armed resistance. Mm-hmm. It involved large-scale international boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. It involved a large-scale delegitimization campaign of white South Africa in international forums and institutions. It's a long process. And I would say that this one is bigger and harder. But if people wish to see it happen, that's unfortunately the route that's going to have to be taken. It's going to be a lot of a lot of grassroots building, a lot of mobilizing, a lot of going after their own institutions of state, and a lot less of just showing up at protests. Protests are nice, but that should be the end point, not the starting point.
Das war das Interview mit Chris Whitman von Medico International in Palästina, Israel, und das war's mit der Sendung. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und zum Schluss einfach noch zwei ganz kurze Agendapunkte. Kreis 13, das Kasernenareal wurde besetzt. Es gibt das ganze Wochenende Musik und Veranstaltungen. Check it out auf kreis13.zureich.rip. Und als zweiter Punkt eine performative Lesung im Paranoia City morgen Samstag um 17 Uhr. Lohnt sich definitiv, dort vorbeizugehen. Es geht um das Buch Tofan. Es ist ein Sammelband über revolutionäre Wünsche und Hoffnungen. Vielen Dank, habt ihr zugehört. Es war super toll, mit dir Sendung zu machen. Sidonia, Han ist gerade ins Studio gekommen. Und tschüss.
Bye.
Bye.